welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Welcome to Syosset Library's Turn the Page podcast. I am Jessica. My co-host today is...
Jen, hello.
So we are welcoming back an amazing author who I believe last time you were on Turn the Page, it was We Could Be Heroes, which was one of my favorite books.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And please tell the audience who you are, and we will begin talking about your new book.
I am Mike Chen. I am the writer of the newly released Light Years from Home, which came out just a few months ago, this past January. My other books are We Could Be Heroes, which Jessica just mentioned before that, A Beginning at the End, which was my post-pandemic book that came out before the real pandemic, like right before the real pandemic hit, and that was really terrible. and Here and Now and Then, which was up for a bunch of awards, and I think it's probably like my best known one. And in a few months, my Star Wars book comes out, Star Wars Brotherhood, about Anakin and Obi-Wan, right after Attack of the Clones.
Very exciting. And I do want to talk about that after we talk about Light Years from Home. And just say, you know, you were actually put on my radar for that post-pandemic, beginning of pandemic book by Annalee Newitz, who...
They did a thing
with us early in the pandemic. We were having these coping with pandemic special episodes, and they mentioned that your book was a good book to read while coping with the pandemic, I guess because it was post-pandemic when the pandemic was happening. So thank you, Annalee.
Yeah, no, that book, it's a weird experience because that book is about like rebuilding community after like a horrific loss. And it was really supposed to be like, it was supposed to be like a pandemic as a metaphor for both generational trauma and individual trauma. And then it became a real thing. And all of the world building in there like came to life with like masks and sanitizers and air filters and distancing and all these things that I'm like, well, at least I got it right.
So talking about generational trauma in general, Jen, did you want to dive right in here about Light Years from Home?
Absolutely. So I am really glad that you brought that up because that was something that I saw at work in Light Years from Home too. There's a lot there about generational trauma and even individual trauma and how that affects family dynamics and how that affects relationships and how people, you know, see themselves like in the world. And I'm wondering, it sounds like that's been a sort of like constant thread in your work. And I'm wondering what led you to choose a sort of alien invasion framework for exploring those topics this time around?
So I realized when I was like early on when writing this, was right after We Could Be Heroes came out. And I was doing publicity for We Could Be Heroes. And I realized I kept talking about things like the impact of like, you know, your parents have on you and like memory and things like that. And I'm like, wait a minute, I've covered this ground before. And I'm like, oh no, I had that realization that I'm like, this, every writer kind of has like their thing that like they unconsciously go back to. I'm like, I think my thing is like, memory and identity and like generational trauma and identity and like figuring out your stuff. So this one was a little bit more conscious of doing that because what the biggest influence of it was the Netflix series The Haunting of Hill House. So not the novel, which is excellent, but completely different from the series, but the series itself, when I saw it, so for those that have not seen it, it's about a family, like you see them in the past and you see them in the present. And in the past, they are just completely destroyed by this haunting at this house that they're renovating for the summer. And then the present catches up with them to see like how this supernatural event just totally fractured them as they tried to come back together for an important event. And when I finished watching that, I thought, God, I wish I could write something like that. And I had written, but not sold, a short story about a boy who, it was inspired by a song that, like, the theme of the lyric is about a boy who, like, wishes to be taken away by aliens because he's in such a bad situation, and then it actually happens. And so I wrote a short story around that, and it kind of merged two together. So it was the idea of, like, wish fulfillment, like extreme wish fulfillment that, you know, you think this will never happen, but it actually does, combined with the format of The Haunting of Hill House, which is like the, you know, fantastical fracturing of families. So the generational trauma in this one was definitely, it was not a subconscious, like, oh, this is the thing that I write about. It was the, like, I saw a story format that I really, really liked with Hill House, and I wanted to adapt it into something of my own.
I loved the characters. I loved them. They were messy. They were absolutely infuriating at times in their own ways. So you have twins, Jacob and Cass, although Jacob is the one who gets taken away by aliens. You find out he returns early in the book, but you get to see what happened in the past. And it did, I guess, you know, fracture their family in so many ways. But he was such, like, a interesting guy. Just sort of seeing him in the before and the after was ridiculous, because you really see him in the after before you see, like, what he was like. Yeah. And then you see the impact that he had on his sisters, Cass, who's his twin, and then Evie, who I believe she was the younger one, right?
Yeah, she's like 2.5 years younger.
Yeah. How did you decide to make him a twin? And, you know, where in the birth order that these three were going to be?
So I always knew that there were going to be three siblings. So the way that I work, I usually come up with a concept, and then I write an outline to see if there's actually a story there, because I have many concepts with no story. Like, they're like two great lines of a pitch and nothing that actually supports it. So once I realize that there's actually a story there, then I have like the framework for who these characters are. Their personalities don't really get developed until after the first draft, because there's a lot of like filling in the blanks to give them like the quirks that make them who they are. But to at least get the sketch of like the directions that the characters have to go, I have, as a writer, you have to just kind of like assign these roles that, you know, you consider like, how does it work better? I thought, I played around with this quite a bit, like switching, like, is it three siblings of like completely different ages? The twins thing worked because I ultimately decided that Jacob and Cass would be the twins, because I wanted them to kind of like be in like the same point in their life in college. I wanted them to essentially kind of switch roles. So Cass, both of them are like student athletes. They're not the best at academics, but Jacob has really kind of gone into like the party boy thing. And well, Cass had recovered from that. And so Cass is like on her route to graduation, but Jacob, when he gets abducted, like Cass has like this, feels like this responsibility, like someone has to take care of this. And she's already gone through, like, you know, I've had definitely like friends, you know, who I met in college, and they had like their one or two like really bad years in college, and like they, you know, they realize like how to become responsible from that. And so Cass is kind of like a reflection of that, but taken to an extreme level. I thought Evie had to be younger. That's really, really important, because she's the one who's looking up to her siblings the whole time, but she's also kind of the forgotten one of the family. As sometimes happens in families of multiples. It was important to establish that she had a strong relationship with Jacob, because she felt like Cass didn't listen to her. So she's looking at her older siblings as kind of like this set pair, but she only really connects with one of them. And so when Jacob is gone, it's really important for her to suddenly devote her life to that. So there was like, you know, with the three characters, like I switched things around initially, but this really felt like it worked for the dynamic that I wanted to play, because they all needed enough flexibility to be able to move around in how they felt about each other. But they all had to have like a really strong set starting point. And this seemed to work the best.
Something I thought that was depicted really well in the book is the way in which, you know, members of a family, all of the people in the family will like grow and develop personalities and make choices and kind of grow in their own directions. But when you bring the family unit together again, people tend to revert to earlier, like
very much. You
know? And I saw that at work here, and I was wondering if that was something that you were conscious of.
Yeah, it was. It's something that that I have noticed with myself as I've gone to a lot of therapy. I've talked with my therapist about it, and there's actually a term for it. I forget what it is, but she said like, oh yeah, that happens, where like grown adults who, you know, they've grown into like their 40s and 50s, but when they're back together, they're suddenly like 17 again and just bickering about really stupid stuff. I really wanted to dive into that, because I think that's really fascinating about how like very specific elements of your environment can kind of like dictate how you act. Just like how, you know, if you go back to, it's not just with family, but it's like, if you go back with your college friends that you haven't seen in 5 years and you're suddenly all together again, you start acting like idiots again. So yeah, that was very conscious. I wanted to show here that not only like are these people completely changed, but the fact that they haven't really seen or talked to each other, because Evie and Cass do not talk to each other. There's a lot of animosity between them. And so their projections that they have of each other is stuck with how they remember each other 5-10 years ago, not the people that they've become. And that happens a lot. One of the things I did not really consciously think about this when I was writing, but I see how a lot of pandemic life has actually seeped into this, the idea of like being stuck and like physical and emotional separation due to like a catastrophic event. And then like, how do you revisit and reconnect after that? I think there's gonna be a lot of stories, both in books and in TV and movies, that are gonna have these themes just like unconsciously woven into them, because I did not really pick up on this until I was rereading like right before release, when I was rereading it, because I've forgotten so much of this book because of pandemic stress and pandemic parenting. And I needed to be able to talk about it. So I was rereading it. I'm like, oh, I see where that is. Like, ooh, that kind of hurts. but yeah, so like the point about reverting back to who you are when you're around family, like that was a very intentional point.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, especially in the pandemic times. I know, first of all, as the mother of twins, it was very interesting to watch young kids, and I'm sure, you know, you have a young child as mm-hmm. well, sort of develop, you know, during their formative time, during isolation. But also when you're talking about reverting to your former self, you know, my brother and I did see each other more during the pandemic because we were kind of in the same bubble, mm-hmm. even though he lives far away, for the same reason we all stayed kind of isolated, and we did, you know, revert back to our old selves fighting over Nintendo games, yeah. which was interesting. But yeah, I think that the personalities of everybody was just so well crafted. But I also want to talk a little bit about like the trauma they're going through with this. So they lost their father, who mm-hmm. never was able to get past the fact that he felt that Jacob's abduction was his fault. And of course, mm-hmm. nobody really 100% believed him that there was an abduction by aliens. I mean, but their mother was suffering from something else, where really like her whole self and her memory was being taken from her.
So the way that the family dynamics play out in the past, you see their father kind of become like this guilt driven obsession about like, I have to find my son because this thing happened to him and it was because I took him here. And I think like that's a pretty common reaction. I think like when something bad happens and like a parent feels responsible for it, it's like, you know, that all of the things that I try to play with here are pretty common reactions to like really bad things. And the nice thing about putting it into a science fiction framework is that you get to take it to extreme levels to kind of like put up that mirror to you know, humanity and society. And with the mom, in the past, you see that she's like, we're just going to march forward. That's the only way we can do it. And it's a bit of a reaction to what her husband is doing, but it's also like the, like, this is the only way I know how to do things, like, type of approach. And I think that's also a very common reaction that you'll see with like when something just goes wrong. It's like, you know, you have people who, I mean, again, the pandemic has shown that you have people who are just, you know, kind of divesting themselves from reality. And then you also have people who are just like, there's nothing I can control. So I'm only going to control like what I make for dinner or whatever. But then in the present storyline, the mom is suffering from like fairly, I guess like moderate stage, pretty late stage dementia really. And I don't have that much experience with that personally. Like my grandmother, who passed away at 93, like she started to experience it probably in her, I think like 89 or 90 years old, but she didn't really speak much English to begin with. And she wound up like moving back to Taiwan to get for my aunts over there to take care of her, or my uncles. So I didn't have much experience with that other than the stories that they had. So I actually, like, I did a lot of reading to make sure that like this feels accurate. And I had some sensitivity readers to come in, because it's part of it is like, I needed a plot necessity to create some sort of like health issue that Cass is dealing with, like from her mom's perspective. But I wanted to make sure that, because this whole idea, a lot of this book is about memory and interpretation of memory. Like, it really felt thematically appropriate to do. I just wanted to make sure that it was done respectfully, so it didn't just feel like a plot point in there. So I had several people read it and make sure that they were, you know, totally cool with what I was doing.
I have a question about Evie, because I think that her reaction to the terrible things happening is really interesting, in that she becomes almost monomaniacal about exposing this alien abduction and the invasion that then, you know, is foretold. And I want to connect that to like a question about what the book's like pop culture DNA is, because it's interesting to me that, because it takes place now, but it also takes place in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And there's something that's very 90s about like alien invasions, you know, because like X-Files was so popular. And Evie like struck me as almost like a Fox Mulder type, you know, from.
Yeah. I in like the very early draft, I like there were a few like off the cuff mentions of X-Files, and I thought like, I can't do that. That's too meta, because it is a clear influence on this book, like on so many levels. Like, so for deep X-Files nerds, Lake Kinboat, the place that the abduction happens is actually a reference to Lord Kinboat from the episode Jose Chun's from Outer Space. So, and like X-Files is very, very important to both me and my wife. So in this universe, I had to pretend like it, that doesn't exist. But like the general, I mean, there were so many things in the 90s. I was born in the late 70s. So I was like a teenager in the 90s. And like, it wasn't just X-Files. It was like, there was like the Time Life series of books on like UFOs and ghosts, and they
they
came out of infomercials. Those
commercials that were on during, man, I guess when we were home sick from school, where like a man points something at Stonehenge, and weird commercials.
There was also there was a pre-X-Files show called Sightings, which was it was on Fox, and it was about like it was kind of like Unsolved Mysteries, but from like a paranormal perspective. So like the host would go interview people who claimed to be abducted by aliens. So like there was a lot of this in like the atmosphere at the time. So like Evie is kind of a riff on that, like in like the late 90s, early 2000s, like the fervor of this. Evie, it was really, really important to for her to have a strong relationship with Jacob. So you see how, like, even though she has nothing in common with her brother, she feels he is the only one who actually listens to her in the family. So when he is gone, and she has a scientific background, when you meet her when she's young, she's in, I think, her sophomore year of college, and she's studying astrophysics. So she has a scientific background. So she's already thinking about this. And the fact that like her dad becomes obsessive with UFOs, and she's, you know, she decides like, well, let me look at it from a scientific perspective. And she starts to cling on to it. And it's all about the relationship with her brother, because she is so, it's not a guilt thing. It's more of like she feels like she owes it to him because he listened to her. So I think it's one of those things where, again, like if you grounded it in the real world, people do these things all the time when something bad happens. You're driven by what we feel we owe each other, and it's not always framed in like the healthiest execution. So Evie is that just kind of like taken to a really extreme level where she becomes a UFO YouTuber in the present day.
That was super fun. I really appreciate that really weird, quick memory lane thing that happened before, because until very recently, like 5 seconds ago, I forgot all about all that Time Life series.
Do you remember the alien autopsy video from the 90s?
Yes, yes. So there was that, and there was also the Fact or Fiction TV series hosted by Jonathan Frakes of Star Trek The Next Generation. Classic. So I was super into that. Like I remember even at the toy store, like under like spinnable bookshelf thing, like they would have like the not the Time Life books themselves, but they would have like the DK soft cover versions of those types of topics. So I was super fascinated with that at the time. Ironically, like I actually didn't watch X-Files until I think season 4 or 5 or something like that, because all of my friends were into it and I thought like, oh, I'm too cool for this. But then I got sucked into it in college. And then, you know, like then I married my wife, who was just like obsessive about it. So like it's definitely like when I think of the topics of my books, and I might have talked about this when we talked about We Could Be Heroes, because my debut was a time travel book. And right away I got asked, like, are you going to write more time travel? And I'm like, I don't want to be the time travel guy. And so I kind of made like this internal decision of like, I want to hit all of the subgenres that I really, really love before I revert back to time travel or whatever. So this one is a very conscious blend of like light space opera, but mostly X-Files.
I liked all of the off-screen space opera. I thought that was pretty inventive, that, you know, you knew it was happening, but it was really more about the home life. It was done really, really well.
So the only space opera, I often joke that the book is 10% space opera, 90% domestic drama. And the only true space opera you see is the very first chapter. And we almost didn't have that in there. Like my editor and I debated about like, should we put this first chapter with Jacob in there? Like, is it too jarring from a tonal perspective? But I thought it was really important that if we didn't get at least one scene with that, then everything Jacob talked about would be like kind of like at a distance. And it was really important that you see what Jacob sees, because there start to be questions about, like, does he have delusions of grandeur? Does he have schizophrenia? Is his brain just totally jacked up from all the drugs he did for a decade? And so it was really important to show what he saw. And then when he starts talking about the space opera stuff, and then Cass, who becomes a psychologist, starts picking away at it, where she says, like, oh no, he's grabbing, this reference from this and this from this, and his brain is just mashing it all up. It was really important to kind of play with that unreliable narrator thing. So there is this mystery, because I think if you knew one way or the other the entire time, then it would be harder to sympathize with the sisters. I think it's really important, because there's three perspectives. It's really important to give all of them, like, the idea that they've all experienced the same thing and they've interpreted it completely differently, which is one of the things that I wanted to play with.
So that you mentioned that you are writing a book within the Star Wars universe.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Good. And so when does it take place again?
So it takes place almost like exactly in the middle between Attack of the Clones and the Clone Wars movie. The Clone Wars movie is, I think, chronologically, it's not the first story in the Clone Wars series, but it's the first, I guess, like, important Obi-Wan and Anakin story in that series. So it's, I don't think there's a defined time period. I know Lucasfilm likes to kind of keep things vague so they can still insert stories here or there. But the way that chronologically with the books and the movies and stuff, I would say it goes Attack of the Clones, then the upcoming Queen's Hope novel by E.K. Johnston, which ties into my book. Like, I talked with Kate quite a bit about, like, making sure things synced up. Then my book, and then the Clone Wars movie. And you'll see the ending of my book, like, there are, like, clear ties into, like, what you're going to see into, like, the Clone Wars movie. I'm trying to be appropriately vague about that.
Funny you say that. I actually did talk to E.K. Johnston about her Queen series mm-hmm. based on Padme and her handmaidens, and they are super, super cool. You may or may not know that Natalie Portman is from Syosset.
No, I did not know that.
And cool. has been on Turn the Page, and was literally sitting a few desks away from me when she came back after being not in school for 2 weeks to say she was auditioning for those movies. So
wow.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah. I'm starstruck.
I mean, literally, if there was something going around Twitter a few years ago, like, what was your most mundane interaction with a celebrity, and like, that was so mundane I completely forgot that it happened. And then I was like, oh, I sat across the subway from somebody once, and and then, like, a few weeks later I'm like, oh, I also went to high school with Natalie Portman. So it's pretty mundane. But funny enough, before she really became big with Star Wars, going back to Aliens, she was in Mars Attacks, which I really liked that movie.
I haven't seen that in a really long time. I just remember it was very goofy, so I don't remember too much else about it.
I mean, it wasn't great, but I still liked it. but yeah, so there's been so much. Like, Star Wars is just sort of a perennial favorite. And every time people are like, oh, we're done with Star Wars, it never really is. I mean, it really is just sort of a continuous space opera. But I like that, since you write so much about relationships, that this is an Anakin and Obi-Wan story.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it was, I know, so with Star Wars, like, as authors, like, you don't get to ask, like, they come pick you for specific things. My agent made it very known that I wanted to do something in this space, and particularly the prequel Clone Wars era. I got to contribute to the From a Certain Point of View anthology for The Empire Strikes Back. And that was kind of like my entry point. It's almost like an audition piece. And with that one, like a lot of the stories are like the person in the background as they watch Han and Leia fight or whatever. And so when I saw the list of characters that I could pick for that anthology, I was brought in about halfway through. And so a lot of the scenes and the characters were taken, but I saw that no one had picked Palpatine yet. And I asked the editor, I'm like, why has no one picked Palpatine? And he said like, oh, I think people are probably too intimidated because there's a lot of weight that comes with Palpatine. And because the only scene that Palpatine is in Empire is where he talks with Vader about Luke. And so I wrote these other pitches, but then I wrote one specifically about Palpatine discovering the identity of Luke and what is the subtext of his conversation with Vader in Empire. And I thought there's no way they're gonna let me do this. I am like a new writer to Star Wars. who am I? I wrote a time travel book. But they let me do it. And it was, I specifically said, like, if I get my pick of these pitches that I wrote, then I want to do the Palpatine one. And it was like the idea of like, go big or go home. And I tied it into Anakin that we know in Clone Wars and the prequels. I wanted it to really be like as deep of a dive into Anakin as you could do from Palpatine's perspective. So then when I got the offer for this book, it was I could not pick a bigger like dream project. I feel like the fact that like I get to fill in this gap that bridges their relationship, because you see them in the Clone Wars movie, they're very buddy buddy, and in Attack of the Clones, they're very like antagonistic, like mentor and apprentice. And so how do you bridge that gap? And that was like the key goal of my book, is like at the very beginning, you see like their relationship is starting to transition because Anakin has just been made a Jedi Knight and Obi-Wan is starting to work with the Jedi Council. And so like, not only is their relationship with each other changing, their like the context of their everyday lives is changing too. And you know, you have to get to their buddy buddy stage somehow. So this was a lot of character work about like them realizing like that they're better off with each other, and if they can accept that, they can have a really good relationship with each other. There's also lightsabers involved, and Asajj Ventress for you Clone Wars fans. She is so much fun to write. She's such a jerk to everyone.
I love her so much. It's funny. I was waiting for somebody. I mean, this is, you know, really like if anybody's watched the Clone Wars, you know what I'm talking about. But I was so waiting in the most recent Boba Fett series for somebody to reference the thing that she did to him when he was an awkward teenager, because man. Yes. That was painful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you read Dark Disciple?
Yes. I sure did. That was a nice little Easter egg that was it Christy? I'm trying to remember who wrote that.
Christy Golden.
Christy Golden. Yeah. Yes. That she put in there that was referenced a few times. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, it is canon. It mm-hmm. happened. It's in the book.
So, God, I can't say much about Ventress, you know, because this is before the book comes out, but I will tell you that she was not in the original pitch. And it was because I thought there's no way they're gonna let me use her. And so when I did the original, the way that the process worked is like, I think my first pitch was maybe like 3,000 words, and like the final synopsis was about 25,000 words. And there were about four or five iterations as we just threw more and more details in there to get everything approved before I started writing. So in one of the early stages of the outline, my editor goes like, oh, well, I think we needed to bring another antagonist in here. Do you want to use Asajj? And I'm like, yes, I do. I would really love to do that. And I actually told him, like, I didn't think I could do that. He's like, oh no, anyone you want to use, just ask. Like they may not say yes, but you know, just ask, like shoot for, you know, whoever you want. And he had suggested, he's like, you know, we haven't really established like, you know, points A, B, and C about Asajj. So like we can try. So I did, and everything was accepted about her. I think I didn't actually have to change anything that I proposed about her. She's even though her screen time she gets a decent but limited amount of screen time in the book because she's a supporting character, but her presence is everywhere. Like, people are like, she is like a complete linchpin in the book, and that was very intentional because she's just so much fun to play with.
I'm very interested in what you just said about like what the process of writing that book was like, and that you had to like have really detailed outlines and get approvals like along the way from the people who control the IP. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how that compares to your normal writing process. Do you have the story details nailed down in the same way, or do you like discover them as you write? Like, how do the two experiences compare?
It's my personal stuff, or I guess like my original stuff. There's a big, big discovery process, and that's really part of the problem with it. Is like, so I write in layers, and the first layer is very skeletal. And I kind of referenced it earlier when I was talking about the family for Light Years from Home, how like in the first draft, I know what their roles are, but I don't know who they are as people. And as I am writing that first draft, little things start to come to the surface, and then I can go back and start filling in those gaps. But with an IP, especially one that I know really, really well, it's just like writing fan fiction. It's like fan fiction with parameters and approval process, because I knew the voices right away, and I know the world. And so once the actual plot line gets set up, I remember the first night I sat down and I'm like, okay, I'm actually going to start writing from chapter one. And a usual day for me is like, a good day is like 1500 to 2000 words. A normal day is about like 1000 to 1500 words. And I cranked out 5,000 words. And I'm like, if I didn't have to go to bed, I could still just keep going, because it just, I could picture it, I could hear it. And one thing that that I identified really early on is the, because you see so many sides of Anakin between episode two and the Clone Wars series and episode three. And like, now I understand much more about, I think, what Hayden Christensen, like how he was directed to act, because you see him as like very like formal and monotone. And if you look at Attack of the Clones, like he does that monotone voice only when he's around the Jedi. And when it's just him and Padme, he totally loosens up. And then that evolves into Revenge of the Sith, where when like the opening act of Revenge of the Sith, where it's just him and Obi-Wan like rescuing Palpatine, like their banter there is so similar to Clone Wars banter. So taking it apart scene by scene and looking at like, oh wait, he's not being monotone because he wasn't sure what to do from a direction perspective. Like, this is very intentional. And I started to see that more and more about like where he was, like the acting choices that he was making. And so to integrate that into the voices of Anakin and Obi-Wan, like both from an internal dialogue perspective, because I do very tight points of view in all of my work. So the Anakin chapters are Anakin chapters. You are in his head. The Obi-Wan chapters are Obi-Wan chapters. So it was nice to be able to express that, that like if he's talking to Mace Windu, he's consciously being like, I'm being a Jedi right now. I'm going to, you know, be deferential because Mace Windu is a jerk, but he's my boss. Mace Windu is a jerk, but I love him anyways. But then when you see Anakin in like when he interacts with like the clones or the original characters or Obi-Wan, like he starts off with like being more self-aware of like that sort of deferential phase, but then like it starts to evolve where like they start to see each other as people and rather than just like their roles as master and apprentice. So all of that felt very instinctive, because I have seen so much, you know, of the movies and the Clone Wars like over and over and over. So yeah, it was just like playing with like, I say it's like action figures in my head. And so cranking out the word count, it's funny because I worked so fast on it because like these ideas were just exploding in my head that when I went back to read the drafts, I'm like, there's so many typos in here. And it's because I was going so fast.
I'm really excited. And I think, you know, you have such a great body of work. You have, you know, your standalone novels. So are they all going to be standalone? I know a while back I'd asked if you would ever write in the We Could Be Heroes universe again.
So there's nothing official with that. And I don't have any firm plans. I just have some outlines that, like, if I did want to go back to it, I know where the story could go. But yeah, I know it was, I think it was Neil Gaiman who talked about, like, how he never wanted to write a series. And I see some of my friends who are writing like 2, 3, 4 book cycles. And you know, they say like there's definitely pros and cons to it. Like from a writer perspective, it's much easier to write a second or third book because you don't have to do as much of the discovery process. But from a commercial perspective, there's always the risk of like sales typically drop off a certain percentage with each book in there, unless you're like Brandon Sanderson or someone like that. So for me, I think like, because I always want to explore different subgenres of science fiction, and I also want to play with different sets of characters and different themes, it just makes more sense for me to write standalone. But I really would like to do more with like the seeds that we planted in We Could Be Heroes, because Jamie and Zoe are just a lot of fun to write.
It is always a pleasure to talk to you. I hope that you will come back next time you're writing a book. I see you're writing a book called Vampire Weekend.
I am writing a book called Vampire Weekend that is in the final stages of revision right now. It is, as I like to tell people, it is the most wholesome vampire book that you will ever encounter. It's about a woman named Louise who was turned as a vampire in the 70s. And she uses her immortality to spend most of her time playing in bands and like going to rock shows, because she has never dealt with the generational trauma of being the child of immigrants. So until she is forced to in this book. So it's, and there's a whole other thing about, because with this book, I try to think, with all of my science fiction, I try to ground it in reality. I think that's the fun thing that I really try to do, is like think about these really fantastical situations and what are people actually going to be thinking and feeling? What are the logistics of like if you were a time traveler or whatever? And in this case with vampires, I tried to think about like they can't just be going around killing people, because with smartphones and everything, like we would know. And so Vampire Weekend deals with a lot of the practical bit of that, in like they have to eat somehow, and so there's got to be access to blood bags or blood donors or whatever, and what happens if that's taken away? So I guess it's also a metaphor for capitalism. Like it was something that I was highly on my mind between that and the like a very personal story of being like a child of an immigrant and kind of coming to terms after years of therapy with that, all wrapped up in a book about a vampire who just really loves music and goes to a lot of shows and has a very adorable corgi.
Exciting.
So
oh,
yeah,
my
this
God.
Is, this
yeah.
is like my friend, one of my friends is also writing a very bloody, very sexual vampire book. And we joke that like our books are just so completely different than our vampires. Mine is much more wholesome.
Well, we'll see you when that one comes out.
Yeah, I will be around. And then by then I can talk all about Asajj Ventress and her shenanigans in Brotherhood.
Can't wait. Once again, this was Jessica with Syosset Libraries Turn the Page podcast. My co-host was
Jen. Goodbye.
And our guest was
Mike Chen. Goodbye.
And we are going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.